Hi, this is Anoushka. I know this is a really difficult time. Everyone is feeling unsettled. Over the next weeks and months, we will continue with in-depth coverage of this coronavirus pandemic, speaking to Guardian correspondents across the world. But there will be some other stories as well, including today something that may be helpful if you're feeling anxious. Simon Parkin on whether there could be a cure for insomnia. Journalist Simon Parkin used to struggle with insomnia.
It's one of the most frustrating emotions or places I think I've ever been.
He could not stop associating his bedroom with
being awake, being stressed.
And then at a certain point in the night,
you start to think about how much you've got to do the following day. And it sort of becomes this snowball of frustration and anguish.
Surveys suggest that up to one third of us experience insomnia. An exclusive story for The Guardian this month revealed that it's even a problem for children, with a sharp rise in hospital admissions for sleeping disorders. Simon decided to report on his own experience of sleeplessness, and in doing so, came across a technique that worked. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, can insomnia be cured?
If you share a bed with someone and they're a sound sleeper, that's intensely frustrating. You feel sort of admiration and jealousy, and then the slightest sort of movement they make can sort of send you into this silent rage.
I'm the really annoying sound sleeper next to you. I mean,
right.
Not literally next to you,
right.
Next to my husband. I always wonder if he likes to take his rage out and actually just wake me up in the middle of the night. Did you used to do that?
No, I don't think so. Maybe.
A little
so
poke?
Yank.
Go on, you'll get up to.
Yank on the bed covers or something, yeah.
Are there any famous techniques that people tend to use to help?
Yeah, there are sort of stories of artists and entertainers and their strange rituals that they come up with. Van Gogh apparently soaked his mattress in turpentine, believing that to help.
How does that help?
I've got no idea. I don't know if it did either.
Sounds quite dangerous.
Maybe
actually.
It helped his art. The author of Fight Club would describe laying in his bed and imagining picking fights with people, which, appropriately enough.
I want you to hit me as hard as you can.
Why?
How much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight?
Is Fight Club inspired by insomnia?
Do you know, I think he may have said it was an element in the writing of that.
I couldn't sleep.
No, you can't die from insomnia.
So the American comedian W.C. Fields, he claimed he could only fall asleep with the sound of rainfall in his ears. And so his poor girlfriend would fire a hose at his windows, I believe, to help him drift off, which
that's,
is...
That's true love.
Yeah, beyond the call.
And how little sleep can people be getting?
One thing I have heard since reporting this story on insomnia for The Guardian is that insomniacs underestimate the amount of sleep that they actually do have. So people will often report only sleeping for 1 or 2 hours when in fact they're sleeping for 2 or 3 times that amount when they undergo proper tests.
You know, you get those watches which tell you how long you sleep.
Yes.
And I had a newborn baby. And I was like moaning to everyone. I was like, oh, I'm not getting any sleep. It's absolutely ridiculous. And so I went to sleep from like 12 till 7 and I put the watch on and I clicked sleep. And I woke up in the morning and it said I had slept for 6 hours and 15 minutes. I was like, oh, okay, maybe I am underestimating it.
So, I mean, that maybe that's less important than the feeling of, oh, I've only slept for 2 hours. And so you then have the anxiety the next night and it sort of snowballs like that.
You've written about having just a few hours a night and even sometimes no sleep at all. What impact was that having?
So I was just struggling to concentrate often when I was working the day after a night of relative sleeplessness. I think it was affecting my mood and the amount that I could stay attentive for each day, which is a problem when you obviously have work to do. And then just feeling sort of not exactly depressed, but under some sort of weight or cloud of fatigue, I guess, not quite being able to see clearly. what is in front of you each day.
To research your piece, you spoke to loads of experts and doctors. What is the definition of insomnia?
So insomnia is defined as having adequate opportunity to sleep, but inadequate ability to sleep. And that's what distinguishes it from sleep deprivation, which is where you don't have adequate opportunity to sleep because, for example, I don't know, you've got noisy neighbours or whatever. There's some reason that you can't sleep.
A newborn baby, for instance.
Exactly, yeah.
To be defined as chronic insomnia, does it have to go on for a certain period of time?
Yes, it has to have been going on for 6 months to be clinically described as chronic insomnia.
And how widespread is insomnia in the UK?
So between 1993 and 2007, the number of patients visiting their GPs complaining of insomnia nearly doubled.
And do we know why that is? Is it because more people are aware that this is something that you might want to see a doctor about? Or is it an increase in insomnia?
I think that is not entirely clear. There may be higher rates of reporting of insomnia, but I think what we can also see is that technological advancements, such as the advent of smartphones, which have given us this sense of always being on, always being available, combined with 24-hour news channels, street lighting. The modern world is sort of angled against sleep. It's sort of adversarial to sleep, the environment in which we all live.
And we're starting to understand more about what that means, because having insomnia is not just about being tired the next day. It's all encompassing. I mean, what are the health risks?
So there are quite severe health risks associated with insomnia. A 2016 report from the CDC in America linked insomnia to heart attack, cancer, obesity. Insomnia is linked with chronic depression in almost all cases. And there's also a risk of suicide. People who are suicidal almost always have insomnia as well. Whether it's the cause or the effect is still up for debate.
So that's huge. I mean, in terms of the NHS, for instance, if you're thinking about insomnia, treating it could have huge ripple effect.
Yes, that's right. I mean, not only for these longer term health effects that insomnia contributes to, but also to the, the GDP, perhaps, for just, the number of people who are unable to go to work because they're too tired from not being able to get any sleep.
Right. So if people do seek help, if they do go to their GP, what are they generally told?
So in a relatively short 10-minute session, a GP is rather limited in the advice that they can give. And in very many cases, doesn't necessarily have a huge amount of formal advice that they've been advised to give people. They tend to rely on the old wives' tales of taking a hot bath, making sure that your room is very dark, eating certain foods. It must be hugely frustrating if you are already, you spent a fair amount of time on Google looking at the things that you can do to turn up to your GP, be told a bunch of things that you already know, be told to, eat a banana or something ridiculous like that.
Did you try bananas?
I did, yeah.
Did they help?
I don't think they did. It wasn't a holistic solution, though.
I reckon the banana's less about the potassium and more about just not being hungry.
Maybe, yeah.
And what about drugs? Might they prescribe sleep drugs?
In the UK, there is a widespread reticence to prescribing sleep pills for the long term or even the medium term. I believe that most sleeping pill prescriptions tend to be just for a week long. There seems to be a lot of worry among the medical establishment about the potential long-term effects of sleeping pill use. But of course, the counter to that is that long-term insomnia comes with a huge amount of health risks.
Who's Dr. Hugh Selsick?
Dr. Hugh Selsick is a South African doctor who moved to the UK. He is an insomnia sufferer who became interested in sleep studies because of his own insomnia, wanting to understand it.
Doing stress management, possibly CBT for anxiety can be useful.
Dr. Selsick can pinpoint the date when his insomnia started. It was when he was 19 and he went on a kibbutz in the desert in Israel. And it was the routine that daily life was built around there, a siesta between 11 to 3. And that upset his rhythms and his habits. And from there, he began to suffer with insomnia. When he got to the UK, he was sort of shocked to see that there was very little interest within the psychiatric community around insomnia. And so he decided to counter that by forming a group of doctors who were interested in this. And from there came up with the solution of founding the Insomnia Clinic in Bloomsbury, which is has been running since 2009. And since then, at least, you know, until last year, it's seen more than 1,000 patients. His role there is to treat insomnia, and he has had an unexpectedly high success rate, with 80% of the 1,000 patients who have been through the doors reporting significant increase in the amount that they're sleeping, and half of that number saying that they're fully cured.
And from the beginning, it was incredibly popular. I mean, they had waiting lists that reached 2 years. What was their kind of driving philosophy?
So what Dr. Selsick did that was different to how insomnia was previously treated in the main on the NHS, rather than saying insomnia is always a symptom of something else, which it can be a symptom of restless leg syndrome, for example, or sleep apnea, where you have breathing difficulties. But he was saying there are also a huge number of cases where those are not the physical reasons for insomnia. There's another psychiatric reason for insomnia. Rather than constantly trying to look for what is the cause of this symptom, why not treat insomnia like it is its own affliction?
And treat it with what?
You know, the treatment at the heart of the clinic is to say we need to retrain a person's brain so that instead of associating their bedroom with wakefulness, they come to reassociate it with sleep.
Okay, so we're about to hear the miracle cure. What does he tell patients to do?
So firstly, he tries to dispel this myth of 8 hours. So we have this sort of understanding in our country that we should all be getting 8 hours sleep. That's not true. Some people need less sleep than that. Some people need more sleep than that. If you are a person who only requires 6 hours sleep in order to feel wakeful for the majority of the next day, but you're trying to force yourself to get 8 hours sleep, you'll typically be lying in bed for a few hours, unable to sleep, which will then start to forge all of these negative associations in your mind. And then you can end up having insomnia, even though you're just a person who requires less sleep. The next thing he does is dispel the myth of there is an ideal bedtime. So typically someone who is suffering from an insomnia will think, well, I need to go to bed earlier, so I've got more opportunity to try and sleep. He says that's completely the wrong way around to do it. What you need to do is set a wake-up time, and then you never, ever deviate from that wake-up time. So if you need to be up at 7 o'clock for work that day, you wake up at 7 o'clock on a Saturday, on a Sunday, every day. You don't nap, you don't lie in. And what that
ever?
Ever. No.
What never. If you feel like a nap?
Well, then the cost of that may be that your insomnia comes back. The idea is to establish a routine. For a long-term insomniac, what this will do is sort of recalibrate themselves so that if you always have a set wake-up time and then, you know, you find that you have insomnia and you only drift off at like 5 a.m., but you still wake up 2 hours later, then the next day you're going to be more tired and you'll be able to fall asleep a little bit earlier. And what happens is then over a long period of time, you start to work back and then you find your ideal sleep window for how long you sleep. And the way that he will do that is to do that in fairly small increments. So to begin with, he might say, right, if you are a person who needs, you estimate, 6 hours sleep, you have to wake up for work at 7 a.m. 7 a.m. is your wake-up time. So go to bed at 1 a.m. in the morning. And then you just do that religiously for 5-6 weeks until you start to recalibrate. And then if you want to see if it's possible for you to get more sleep, you just simply move your bedtime back by 15-20 minutes each night. So you would then, you know, go to sleep at 12:40 the next night and see if that still works.
Okay, so I want to get up at 7 and I'm not sleepy till 5 a.m. So I wait till 5 a.m. to go to sleep, or 1 a.m., whatever it is. But there's still a problem if I can't fall asleep. So what do you do then?
If you can't fall asleep, Dr. Selsick says you have to leave your bedroom. So this is to basically try to break the association of lying in bed, being awake, so that you come over a period of time to only associate your bedroom with being asleep or having sex. Those are the two things that he allows you to do in your bedroom.
Why does he let you have sex in there? Doesn't sound very sleepy.
I'm not sure.
Thinks it might be inappropriate in other parts of the house?
Maybe.
And what, nothing else? Can you get changed in there?
No, he advises that people get changed in a different room. You're not allowed to. He even says don't read. I actually do like to read before I go to sleep, but he was saying that's a bad idea because it's very easy to take stock of, you know, how much time has passed where you haven't been able to fall asleep by what page number you're on, for example. So yes, the idea is to eliminate all activity in your bedroom which is not sleeping. So you go to bed. If you're not asleep within 15 minutes, he tells you to get up, go into another room, and you can listen to a podcast, watch a Netflix show or whatever it is, and then 15, 20 minutes later, go back to your bedroom and try again.
Tell me what happened for you.
Within, I would say, even just 2 or 3 weeks, I was finding that I was sleeping the majority of the night. I certainly wasn't lying in bed and fretting in the way that I had been for a really long time before then.
What's your wake-up time?
My wake-up time is 7:50.
7:50?
Yeah.
That sounds like a lie-in.
I know, I work at home.
You've not got kids then. Did you meet any patients from the clinic for whom it had worked?
So one of the most striking stories, one of Dr. Selsick's patients I spoke to, was a lady who, she's now in her early 40s, but had had chronic insomnia since she was a young teen. And she remembers lying in bed and she'd drawn a dot on the wall of her bedroom and would fixate on that and try to watch it for as long as possible before falling asleep. And sometimes, you know, she'd be just staring at it for hours without blinking. Her insomnia was so bad. She had 3 children and she would drop them at school in the morning, having had, she would say, you know, 1 or 2 hours sleep. Perhaps it was more, but that's what it felt like to her. Would then come home, sort of lie on the floor of her bedroom with her laptop, try and do some work, try and eat, and sort of drift in and out of consciousness, was sort of how she put it to me. So it was a very desperate situation for her. And she went along to the clinic fairly skeptically, as most people tend to, I think. She experienced such a major turnaround in her experience with her sleep that she has now decided to give in the business that she was running and try, with Dr. Selsick's help, to establish her own sleep clinic.
What you're describing is basically cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, isn't it? I mean, it's not rocket science. Does Dr. Selsick think that the technique could just be spread out across the country?
Yes, I think he feels like this is not a proprietary secret sauce that he has. It's something that is relatively easy for clinics and doctors around the country to implement. Well, I think Dr. Selsick did come up with the framing of CBT for the insomnia clinic. So the sort of steps that they go through in the 5 sessions that patients who sign up to the clinic are sent through. The use of CBT to treat insomnia is something that has been used widespread in the past in the United States. It's just something that is only really more recently being taken up in the UK.
When you were writing a long read about this, you didn't just speak to Dr. Selsick, you spoke to GPs as well. Were they frustrated about the amount that they were able to help insomniacs?
Yes, I think they were frustrated, yes. And I think one GP I spoke to said that, you know, she tended to just give the usual advice and felt pretty hopeless that she was really able to achieve anything in the 10 minutes. So Dr. Selsick has been putting together, I think, sort of what you can do in a 10-minute session if you're a GP to sort of give a lot more impact in that tiny window.
Simon, thank you very much. That was Simon Parkin, who is now sleeping much better. Go on the website and have a look at his long read. Coming up, the biggest swarm of locusts for generations. Now, when it comes to the climate crisis, you've probably been following bushfires and floods. But in East Africa today, the largest swarm of locusts for generations has become their most pressing environmental problem. The Guardian's Sally Hayden has been out with the army in eastern Uganda in the race to stop the locusts before they lay their eggs and multiply.
In the distance, a locust swarm can look like a black cloud. Then by the time you're in the middle of it, they're everywhere. On the ground, in the air, on plants, on trees. They even got in my shoes. The ones in Uganda are mature, so close up they're yellow and bigger than you'd imagine, I think.
Oh my god.
It's like nothing I've ever experienced before. The desert locust is actually a type of grasshopper, except it moves in swarms. Desert locusts crossed the Red Sea last year, coming to East Africa from Yemen. They've now reached at least 8 African countries, including Somalia, Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda, South Sudan, Tanzania, and even the Democratic Republic of Congo. There are now thought to be billions of locusts in East Africa. A swarm of locusts covering 1 square kilometre contains 40 million locusts that can eat the same amount of food in one day as 35,000 people. And while the older locusts don't do that, which are mainly the type that are in East Africa at the moment, they're laying eggs. And so the new locusts that are going to be born from those eggs are likely to eat a lot more. If not properly tackled, the UN is saying that the locusts could multiply 500 times by June, so that could have terrible consequences for people's food and livelihoods. This is the biggest locust outbreak in most of the countries in East Africa in decades. International organisations are calling for more money. Different governments, they're sending people out with pesticide, essentially. In some countries, they have airplanes to do that. And in other countries, it's just people on foot. In Uganda, the government has deployed the army and they launch nighttime or early morning operations while the locusts are sleeping.
You know, if you want to fight locusts, you have to make sure that you come early, present yourselves as early as possible before sunshine comes. You know, they are always inactive when it is still early. But when sunshine comes, they become more wild and you may not actually do the work of spraying and killing them.
People have been speculating about why this locust swarm has happened now, but the UN has said that it can be climate change related, that there have been abnormal rains, which are good for locusts to multiply. And then also countries are getting hotter, and that's also good for locusts. For me, the surprising part about covering this story was that some of the people I interviewed, some of the farmers, almost seemed quite excited about having seen the locusts. Locusts were something that they had just heard about from their grandparents, and for them to get to see it was actually quite exciting. Having said that, like, the way they explained it was that this was just one of many climate-related problems that they've been suffering from the past few years, including drought particularly, and so they're kind of getting used in a weird way to having to deal with these things.
That was Sally Hayden, and that's all for today. My thanks to Simon Parkin and Sally Hayden. This episode was produced by Nicola Kelly, Elizabeth Cassin and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Ian Chambers and Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.